Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Everybody, welcome to New Books Network, the East Asian Studies channel. I'm Victoria Lupashku, your host for today. And here we are with Frederick Green, who has graciously agreed to talk to us about his work, Bird Talk and Other Stories by Xu Xu, Modern Tales of a Chinese Romantic, which was just published by Stonebridge Press. So hello, Frederick, how are you?
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm very well.
Great. Good. So I won't, I'll try to speak as little as possible about this really exciting translation and really exciting book. And I'll just, let you introduce us to it. And I'll just start by asking you to tell us more about your work in general and how you came to this topic and to writing about and translating Xu Xu's work.
Okay, so you know, this book has been many, many years in the making, and it really grew out of my PhD dissertation, which was on Xu Xu. And I chanced upon Xu Xu and his short story, Ghost Love, which is actually the first story in the anthology, Gui Lian, while combing through the university library at the time for a graduate seminar on Republican period journals. And that was about 15 years ago. And at the time, I was still trying to find a good dissertation topic. And once I started to read more of Xu Xu's fiction, I knew that I had found my topic. And in my dissertation, I tried to do two things. First, I wanted to unearth Xu Xu for Western readers and essentially undertook a conventional author study that analyzed the most significant works and also placed him into the context of his time and his contemporaries, so the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and then post-war period, 50s, because nothing really had been done on him at all. Now, the other thing I tried to do was to argue that Xu Xu was a writer who squarely fits into the canon of romantic literature and whom we need to read within the context of the 20th century revival of romantic aesthetics. After I got my PhD, I wrote a number of articles that further explored these topics. But, I always felt that unless some of his works would be made available to a wider readership in English, he would forever remain an obscure Chinese writer discussed within the ivory tower of modern Chinese literary studies. And then a few years ago, I had the good fortune of meeting two of Xu Xu's children, his son, who lives in Taiwan, and his daughter, who lives in the Bay Area, where I now live and teach. And the two administer Xu Xu's literary estate. Xu Xu himself passed away in 1980. And when I mentioned to them that I really would like to translate some of their late father's stories, they were really excited and very supportive. And so I started to work on the translations. But only after I got Stonebridge Press in Berkeley interested in publishing them, and I suddenly had a deadline to work with. did I really spring into action and eventually completed the project during a sabbatical in 2019. And you know what was really fantastic was that my editor at Stonebridge Press, the wonderful Peter Goodman, gave me pretty much carte blanche as far as the makeup of the book was concerned. You know, I told him that I wanted to present a cross-section of Xu Xu's fiction, But that there would have to be a lot of contextualization for general readers, but that I also wanted to include a scholarly afterwork that spoke to researchers or to readers who really wanted to dig a little deeper.
Yes,
and then I said we needed to reproduce some photographs and documents. And Peter just kept saying, sure, we'll make it happen.
That's amazing.
And then when the project was almost complete, it was actually Peter Goodman who kind of came up with the title, which I think is really ingenious. Not the first part, you know, Bird Talk and Other Stories by Xuxu, that was sort of the easy part. But then the second part, Modern Tales of a Chinese Romantic. You see, all the titles that I had come up with were really convoluted and complex and sounded like, you know, dissertations. But after reading the manuscript, Peter said that, yeah, Xuxu really, you know, is a romantic, both in the philosophical, but also the sort of colloquial sense. And he's really a great storyteller who is firmly grounded in the modern era. So how about Modern Tales of a Chinese Romantic? And that's what we ended up with.
That's great. And there's I personally believe there's the art of picking a title. There's some sort of talent that some people have to just catch, you know, the essence right there.
Yes.
And I think this is great.
I agree. I'm very grateful for him. for doing that.
That's great. Yeah. And then, so as you mentioned, right, the book contains an introduction. And then short stories, and then an afterword where you dig deeper into more conceptual work, into positioning Xuxu in a larger, say, critical context. So the intro, right, it just walks us and introduces us, right, as readers to Xuxu's life and situates him in the Chinese literary and political world. And it's true that before, you know, your work and before this kind of revival, right, it's very little. You can find very little. I try to go on the library's website and search, and yeah, you're right. It was nothing that much, right? So I think the introduction is really good in terms of positioning the author, but also, you know, it would be very useful for students when you teach such a work, right? So with that in mind, I was just about to ask you to walk us through the intro, if possible.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, Xuxu was born in 1908 and died in 1980. And as such, he really lived to see some of the really big social changes and historical events that rocked China in the 20th century. And his fiction in many ways closely is tied up with, you know, with those events. That's why from the beginning, I felt that these stories really needed to be well contextualized and placed into the socio-historical context for 21st century readers, you know, like us and our students and other readers to really appreciate them. But what made his fiction and Xuxu the individual so interesting to me is that the ways in which he responded through his fiction to China's ideological upheavals of the 1920s and 1930s, and then the war of resistance against Japan that ended in 1945, and then the ensuing bitter civil war between the communists and the nationalists that led to the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949, and then the nationalist retreat to Taiwan, and then finally his own exile in Hong Kong, are in many ways really unique and at times put him at odds with his contemporaries. So let me talk about sort of the three or four big stages in his life really briefly. So Xuxu was born into a declining gentry family. When you kind of deal with Republican period writers, you always hear this term, the declining gentry family, you know, a big land-owning family in Ningbo that sort of had fallen on hard times in 1908. And like many of his peers, he received, you know, an early education that was still very much steeped in classical Chinese learning, but he was also exposed to modern schooling and Western ideas that became more widely accepted during the last years of the Qing dynasty and the early Republican period, so the 1920s. In 1927, Xuxu was then admitted to Peking University, Beijing University now, which was then the country's leading center for progressive social and political ideas. And he majored in philosophy, and he developed a lasting interest in the ideas of the French philosopher Henri Bergson, who had just won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1927 and who was really all the rage at the time. And, you know, Bergson's writings on intuition and creativity had a profound impact on writers everywhere, especially on European modernists such as Marcel Proust, Virginia Woolf, and also came to really impact Xu's fictional work. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. In 1933, after he graduated, after he was done with his studies, he moved to Shanghai, which then really was the cultural and publishing hub of China and, you know, the most modern and cosmopolitan city. And he began his literary career under the auspices of Lin Yutang, a very well-known polyglot writer and critic who ran a number of very successful publishing ventures, literary and cultural journals. And Xu Xu first worked as an editor for a number of Lin Yutang's journals. Now, unlike some of maybe his more or better known contemporaries and other progressive intellectuals of those years who supported the leftist or socialist cause, Xu Xu really embraced a distinctly cosmopolitan liberalism and individualism. And he was, you know, in that regard, he was clearly influenced by Lin Yutang, which really renounced violent revolution as a means to a political end. And, you know, the story Ghost Love, Gui Lian, which is the opening story in the anthology, my anthology, which was written in 1937, is very much representative of that. It's a modern gothic tale set in 1930s Shanghai, in which a first-person narrator relates his encounter with a mysterious woman who claims to be a ghost. And then together they go on nightly strolls through Shanghai. And the geography of Shanghai plays a really important role in the story. And while Ghost Love also touches upon the revolutionary struggles of the 20s and 30s and the violence that had ensued, especially after Chiang Kai-shek's betrayal of his communist allies in 1927, the story is really largely skeptical of collective action and ideological narratives, and is really essentially individualistic. Now, Xu Xu then spends a little bit of time in Europe, and this time in Europe, again, has sort of a big impact on his creative work, but then he comes back very quickly when war with Japan breaks out. And then during the war years, you know, much Chinese literature, both of the political left and the right, espoused really patriotic and nationalist narratives that celebrated collective action against, you know, against the enemy. But Xu Xu's fiction and also his drama, he actually also wrote a lot of drama in those years, really kind of explored quasi-existentialist themes and continued to pursue individualism. He wrote a massive serialized novel of love and espionage called The Rustling Wind, Feng Xiao Xiao, which is probably his best known work. But that would have been way too long to include in the anthology. So instead, I chose this this short story, The Jewish Comet, Youtai de Hui Xiang, which is also a cosmopolitan spy story set during the war. And that holds sort of a promise of agency in the fight against global fascism. It starts out in Shanghai, where a female Jewish secret agent enlists a young Chinese man for a sabotage mission against Franco's fascist forces in Spain, and then the two eventually fall in love. I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. And then finally, in 1950, so this is, you know, after the war, and after the Civil War, and after the People's Republic of China, you know, the communists prevail, the People's Republic is founded, Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalists flee to Taiwan. Xu Xu leaves mainland China, but he goes to Hong Kong. So he had come under very harsh attack from leftist critics already in the 30s, but then, you know, even more so in the 1940s. And he knew that he would have to renounce his literary aesthetics if he were to stay in mainland China. And really, you know, I think he was unwilling to align himself with either of the two authoritarian post-war regimes. And so he decided to remain in colonial Hong Kong, which, you know, ironically, is a city he really never felt at home in. He never really embraced as his home. Yet it was also in Hong Kong where, you know, unhindered by ideological constraints, he produced some of his most significant literary works. And it was also during his exile in Hong Kong that this distinct literary aesthetics that I call, you know, romantic or neo-romantic, matured, and that placed him into the proximity of other Western 20th century neo-romantic writers, maybe especially Hermann Hesse. I talk about that a lot in the afterword. And that connects him to a global literary modernity that I will talk a little bit more about later. And these neo-romantic tendencies are nowhere more discernible than in the title story of my anthology, Bird Talk, Niao Yu.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's also the longest, I think, where he takes the time and the space to develop, right, the story and develop the theme and sit with it for some pages. So and you know, the stories do appear to belong to or can be categorized under specific themes. And you know, you mentioned tangentially so far, for example, nostalgia, right? Or the idea of being exiled in a way. So what were the themes for you, and what were the aesthetic undercurrents that made these five titles stand out? I gather they are connected in a way to Su Xu's literary evolution or his life, but what were the things important to you in choosing these?
Yeah. So, you know, nostalgia is definitely a very important theme, and especially in the story Bird Talk. You know, Bird Talk starts out in post-war Hong Kong, where the narrator receives word of the passing of his fiancée from many, many years ago. But then most of the story is narrated as a flashback and takes the reader back to the pre-war, you know, to pre-war China, and especially the pre-war Chinese countryside, where the narrator, you know, was convalescing from illness, and where he meets a shy and introverted girl who appears to be able to communicate with birds, hence Bird Talk. And he's intrigued by her unusual talent and offers to school her in conventional subjects if she agrees to teach him bird talk or bird language in return. But his attempts at socializing her, you know, they prove just as futile as her efforts at teaching him bird talk. And the only subject the girl excels at is poetry. And in fact, when reading poetry, she experiences the same kind of sublime happiness as when she talks with birds. And then after the two eventually separated, the narrator ends up in post-war Hong Kong, a city that, you know, forever removes him from the pastoral ideal of pre-war Chinese countryside, but also really, of course, from pre-war China as a whole. You see, Xu Xu's exile in Hong Kong, you know, was not voluntary. So like many other refugees, he had thought that it would be temporary, you know, just a few years at most. And when he left China in 1950, he left behind his wife and his newborn daughter, thinking that they would soon reunite. However, as the Cold War escalated, you know, his exile became permanent and he never saw his wife again. He only, you know, very briefly reunited with that daughter just before he passed away in 1980. She was allowed to visit. So he later divorced his wife when it became clear to him, or to both of them, I guess, that her connection with him really became a political liability. You know, and he, you know, he later married again in Hong Kong, and he, you know, he had a new family, but this sense of loss, you know, that really must have been overwhelming. And, you know, many critics who, especially, you know, who write about diasporic Chinese literature have commented on the fact that nostalgia and the yearning for the lost homeland constitutes really the defining characteristic of post-war diasporic literature in Chinese. And this literary phenomenon is particularly visible in Hong Kong's post-war literature, precisely because almost all of those writers, were exiles who had left the People's Republic of China, who had come south to Hong Kong, and hence they're usually referred to as the writers who came south, Nanlaizuojia. And Xu Xu was just one of them, but, you know, there were many, many others. So, Sima Changfang, Li Huiying, poets like Li Kuang, Zhao Zifan. And, you know, nostalgia really, I think, is one of the defining characteristics of this post-war work, especially out of Hong Kong. So that probably is, I think, the most important.
Right. And then, you know, it's, would you say that the short stories and nostalgia in general are representative of an entire generation, even Xu Xu's generation, or, because it does seem that a lot of the people you mentioned, and others as well, felt this idea of just going to Hong Kong or going to other places temporarily, and then they will come back. But then times just changed so much and so fast that even if they were to come back, say, to the places they left from, things would not be actually the same, right?
Yeah, very, very much so. The five stories, they span a period of about 30 years. So I said that, the selection really is, I wanted to give a cross-section of Xu Xu's work. So they start in 1937. The last story is published in 1965. And as such, they offer the reader sort of a glimpse, really, of China's turbulent 20th century. And they all represent a different creative period in Xu Xu's life. So we already said that Ghost Love is from the pre-war period. The Jewish Comet is from the war years. And then Bird Talk, Bird Talk is from the post-war years, this period of exile. And then the last story, the fifth story, When Ahang Came to Gosing Road, is from the 60s. And it's sort of about Hong Kong as it developed into the economic powerhouse that we might think of today. But, to get back to your question about this idea of exiles and whether it's representative of an entire generation. So I already mentioned that Bird Talk really engages with the topic of nostalgia for this bygone era, a world lost, the Republican period. And so there is another story. So the next story in the anthology is a story called The All Souls Tree by Ling Shu. And it's likewise a story that is really representative, as you said, of an entire generation of exiles, I think. So this story is actually set in Taiwan after the nationalist retreat to the island, following their defeat by communist forces. Its topic, this topic of the story, is sort of a death-defying love of a young couple that is separated on account of the civil war. One of them is back in mainland China, and the female protagonist is in Taiwan. It's quite a tragic story. It's quite beautiful, but it's also, tragic. Yeah. I don't want to spill all the beans. But the story, I think, relates this tragedy experienced by, countless Chinese people affected by the political reality of the post-war world order, not least Xu Xu himself. Now, what's interesting is that, at the same time, the story, The Old Soul's Tree, delves into mythical and sort of quasi-religious epiphanies that Xu Xu often used in his fiction to give voice to his, aesthetic convictions that art, can explore sublime or otherworldly experiences that might offer maybe comfort to those grappling with, the pain of loss and homesickness, really. So yes, I think some of the stories, and maybe especially, Bird Talk and The All Souls Tree, really, I think, would have spoken to, but also on behalf of an entire generation of exiles. Yeah.
And it's also the, the language element, right? Because, you know, he does uses these religious elements, or he uses the trope of the spy, or, you know, the love. There's always some sort of love relationship that is happening in the stories to give voice or to enable some feeling or some state to come out through his prose. So I was fascinated about this idea of the language and how it's not just the written word, but all these almost intuitive, as you said, right? And you can totally see the philosophic influence on his work, right? The intuitive type of communication or longing or, you know, finding a vocabulary for oneself that comes out of Xuxu's work. And then, you know, that thinking of that, I just was wondering about what the process of choosing these stories to translate looked like for you. And, you know, what were the decisions you took as a scholar and translator?
That's a great question. Even though Xuxu was so prolific. He wrote so much. His collected works were numbered 15 volumes, and that wasn't even complete. When they were published.
Wow.
And he's written so many stories, especially short stories. It was actually quite easy to settle on this selection. I had to include Ghost Love, Gui Lian, the first story, because it's probably his most famous short work of fiction, the one that really made him a literary celebrity when it was first serialized in 1937. I wanted to include a work from the wartime period, but because his epic, The Rustling Wind, Feng Xiaoxiao, this really long novel, was way too long. I mean, that's, in Chinese, it's like 600 pages. was serialized over an entire year in a newspaper. So that was out of the question. That's why I settled on The Jewish Comet. And it's a really interesting story, I think, because it also explores the fate of Jews in pre-war and wartime Shanghai, which is another really, really interesting topic, and one that, strangely, only very, very few Chinese writers wrote about. We can talk about that maybe a little later. Now, Bird Talk, Niao Yu, is my absolute favorite story by Xuxu, so that had to be included. it was actually also Lin Yutang's favorite story. So Lin Yutang and Xuxu stayed close until, Lin Yutang, I think, died first in 1976 or 7, and then Xuxu soon after. So they stayed close, and Lin Yutang really loved the story, and he made a translation of it, but a very free translation, and he kind of changed a lot of the cultural elements, which I thought was interesting because he probably thought it wouldn't be appreciated, if it was translated literally. I don't know. And it wasn't widely distributed. So I thought, Bertog really had to be included. Oh, and I only just a few days ago I learned that it was also the favorite story of the Taiwanese writer Sun Mao.
This
female writer from the sort of 70s, 80s, very well known writer, female writer, and
yeah.
I did know that she and Xuxu were very close. He sort of became sort of like a mentor figure to her, and they frequently communicated. I think he knew her father quite well.
How interesting.
I was able to see some of the letters that that she had written to him. So Xuxu's daughter, the one who administers the estate, allowed me to see some of these letters, and she kept mentioning to him how much she loved the story Bird Talk. So that was kind of, really, really interesting in retrospect.
Yeah.
Bird Talk, I figured had to be included. And then, the Old Souls Tree, the story about this couple separated by the Civil War, that was actually included in a Chinese language anthology of Hong Kong Writers from the 1950s that was edited by Liu Yichang. And I thought it would be, you know, it would be good to include a work that had sort of been canonized in the Hong Kong literary canon already. And then finally, when Ah Hung came to Go Sing Road, the last story was really one of the last works of fiction that Xu Xu wrote. And it really depicts a shift in his writing and also, I think, in Hong Kong literature of the 1960s, in that it sort of became kind of more kind of middle brow, appealing to a much wider audience. So the story, you know, published in 1965, is kind of a Cinderella story that describes the fate of a young girl called Ah Hung, a young woman who is, she comes from mainland China to work as a maid in a rich person's household, and then who ends up as the wife of a rich businessman. And the story is narrated through the eyes of these three poor immigrant friends who are rewarded for their loyalty to Ah Hung by being given a store in a newly built Kowloon high-rise. And it's kind of written in a light and very colloquial style, and it very much resembles the popular radio fiction that enjoyed great popularity in Hong Kong in the 50s and 60s. So works of fiction that were really written to be performed on the radio or read out on the radio. Or the kind of story that was turned into movies by one of the many studios in Hong Kong in the, you know, 50s and 60s, the Hong Kong movie industry really takes off. And Xu Xu actually wrote several screenplays in those years and was involved in the sort of turning some of his novels into movies. So I thought this last story, which I think from a literary perspective might be a little weaker, but at the same time, I think it's really interesting because it really shows us what sort of, you know, maybe the wider Hong Kong reading public, kind of, you know, would have craved for. So yeah, that's kind of what motivated the selection.
Right. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And as you're describing the last story, it just dawned on me that it's the only one in your anthology where there's a third person narrator. It's not told from the first person involved narrator. So that's a shift, I thought.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. You know, this first person narrator is something that you see in almost all of Xu Xu's fiction. And what's really interesting is that often the first person narrator in the stories, you almost think of him almost as sort of as a quasi autobiographical narrator, because the narrator usually shares a lot of the features of Xu Xu's own biography. And then he's even often called Xu or Xu Xu, written with the same characters. And I think it's quite deliberate. It's sort of all part of his fictional project.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I mean, it's and it's also playing a little bit with the readers, right? Because you know, the fictionalized and the semi autobiography just blend together so well that, you know, you kind of start to guess, like, okay, so is this true, or like, it doesn't matter, or, you know, so there's some sort of very nice interweaving, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, speaking of interweaving all sorts of threads, in the afterword, you mentioned the connection between romanticism, Xuxu's work, and his trips, right, to Europe and Japan. And I was wondering whether you could expand a little bit more on that connection.
Yeah. So Xuxu's earliest fiction from the 30s was really characterized by a very distinct cosmopolitanism and really exoticism, paired with an emphasis on romance. So there's always a love story. And it's what's interesting is that it's often a cross-cultural love story, actually.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And then there's always sort of a sublimation of love. So love really is very important in his fiction. Now, in my anthology, I didn't really include any of those sort of very early kind of exotic works, but I briefly discussed them in the afterword, as they really already kind of were imbued with this romantic sensibility that becomes stronger later on. Now, much of the exoticism drew on his travels to Europe as a young man. So, you know, he said he went to France, he spent time in England, he traveled quite widely. And there is a short story that he wrote in 1936. It's called The Goddess of the Arabian Sea, Alabo Haida Nushan. And, you know, that's really a good example of this kind of exoticism. It describes the encounter on board a steamer to Europe between a first-person narrator. Here we have that first-person narrator, the young Chinese cosmopolitan man, and a beautiful Arab woman who claims to be a sorceress. And when she tells him a tale of a young goddess who roams the waters they are passing through, the narrator excitedly exclaims, "I want to pursue all artistic fantasies because their beauty to me is reality." And then he announces that in this world, there are people who pursue dreams of the real, while I'll seek out the real within dreams. And, you know, here the narrator or, you know, or Xuxu, the writer, really echoes some of these Bergsonian concepts of intuition that provide artists with the impetus to seek truths and realities beyond the purely mimetic, and that continue to shape Xuxu's fictional worlds. You know, this idea that, you know, he's not really interested so much in reality, especially not sort of the grim and gray kind of social realism. No, you know, he's he's into dreams and fantasies. And it's precisely this kind of turning away from social realism that really got him into trouble and that he was criticized for later on. So in 1945, there's an essay that appeared that was written actually on ghost love, Guilian, that was written by a young Marxist critic. He was called Shi Huaiqi. He then tragically died, I think, soon or even before this. His collection of criticism was published. But, you know, this criticism, it's scathing. And it really revealed the incompatibility of Xuxu's idealist aesthetics with the very much utilitarian role art was supposed to play in communist China. So in this essay, you know, the critic condemned what he called the corrupting and degenerating effects of Xuxu's work on upright revolutionaries, claiming that, and I'm quoting here, "it will invariably cause you to forget the cruel reality of the world, cause you to ignore the hideous scars of our nation, lead you to distance yourself from the cruel struggle between old and new that is currently being carried out all around us. Instead, it will invite you to enter an illusionary world." And then he advises his readers to throw these works into the cesspool. and, you know, what the critic clearly has taken issue with was Xuxu's obvious rejection of and opposition to social realism that really had, you know, become the predominant mode of the literary left and that, you know, was promoted in earnest and that later became the, you know, the new orthodox kind of way of writing following the founding of the PRC, and that later then became, of course, socialist realism. But, you know, accessing dreams and illusionary worlds and alternative spheres of reality really had become central to Xu Xu's literary quest. And, you know, his later stories even more so, where this distinction between reality and illusion is sometimes altogether blurred. There's another story that, again, I didn't include it in the anthology. It's from 1947. It's called Hallucination. And the story's narrator here meets a painter, and the painter, you know, he tells him that he gazes at his own oil paintings, and then he's able to access his own past and temporarily relive the happiness that he knew with his now deceased lover. And then the painter insists, you know, the narrator sort of, you know, he doesn't quite believe what the painter is telling him, but then the painter insists, and again, I'm quoting from the story, he says, "Illusions and reality are very difficult to tell apart, for reality may consist of the common illusions of the majority, while an illusion can be one person's reality." You see, this deliberate blurring of illusion and reality, as well as past and present, again, echoes very much, I think, the philosophy of Bergson, and of course of other, you know, earlier Romantic philosophers, and that really encourages the artist to transform reality through art. And that became more and more pronounced in Xu Xu's post-war fiction. And, you know, we've seen this in Bird Talk, and we've seen it in All Souls Tree. But again, it's the kind of work that, you know, would not have been allowed in, and wasn't allowed in mainland China after 1949. You know, and again, it was the reason why he left and why he had to leave mainland China.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when I was reading the afterword and the critique, right, of Xu Xu's work, I was actually thinking it's such an inverted type of, so of course it's critique, right? And at the time, you know, his Xu Xu's work, of course, right, was in direct contradiction with the ideal, literary ideal of the time. But, you know, if someone would say, to say an author right now that, oh, you know, the readers can actually lose themselves into the writing and can access the dreams through your writing, that would be amazing, right? It would be such a...
I completely agree. And, you know, when Xu Xu read this criticism, he must have thought, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing, because that's what we need. You know, yes, the world is being torn apart, and all these scars are being inflicted on us. Don't we need literature that takes us away from this? And that, but yeah, so such were the times. And of course, you know, something that I always try to tell my students is that, you know, writers in China and intellectuals, you know, had a much more visible role in society. I mean, even today, but, you know, back in the 1930s, you know, there was always this question, well, he was only a writer, you know, who cares? And, well, you know, people did care. And, of course, yeah. Literature did enter, you know, the public sphere. And, you know, we know that, right, the Cultural Revolution was triggered by a play, you know, a play. So this idea that, you know, being a writer of love stories could really get you into very, very serious political trouble, I think is something that, you know, it's difficult for 21st century students or readers or any of us, you know, living in this country, it's difficult to comprehend. But, you know, it was a reality, certainly was a reality then, and is still a reality in China today.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also it's to one degree, you know, the fact that we are connected, you know, globalization happened and still happening, and, you know, you can access everything through the internet, doesn't necessarily click with this idea of talking you know, across transnational canons or talking, you know, with different types of literatures across the world and between them. However, right, so Xu Xu did that, and you do mention that his post-war fiction, right, quoting, contributes to a romantic transnational canon and constitutes a creative engagement with romantic aesthetics that link modern Chinese literature to a global literary modernity. Right. So after that, I was kind of, you know, thinking of today and connectivity and things like that. But more specifically, I was wondering whether you could tell the listeners more about the connection, right, that specific connection between Chinese literature and global modernity that Xu Xu contributed to, whether you think was knowing or unknowingly, you know, just, you know, what happened there.
Okay. Yeah. So I mentioned that Xu Xu was very fond of the work of Henri Bergson. And, you know, Bergson was probably the most widely read philosopher of the pre-war years. And, you know, he really had a huge impact on modernist and neo-romantic artists everywhere. You know, Bergson himself, of course, was an heir to the romantic philosophers of the 19th century, in that he appealed to the artist to seek for truths and realities beyond the purely mimetic. And, you know, like Schelling before him, who saw the aesthetic act as the highest act of reason, Bergson believed that the artist had an intuitive ability to enter into immediate communication with an object, with nature, with the self. And this belief in art's ability to grant access to truths and realities defined of scientific reason and customarily hidden by our everyday experiences greatly appealed to Xu Xu. And, you know, he frequently explored it in his fiction. You know, maybe most visibly in Bird Talk. But Xu Xu's reaction of realism really was quite deliberate, and it turned into hostility, you know, after literature became more and more politicized in the newly founded PRC and socialist realism became the only accepted art form. He wrote an essay in the 1950s, and he makes the point that the various contemporary artistic currents, you know, in mid-20th century Europe or the West, but of course, you know, which extended also to China, like surrealism and symbolism and neo-romanticism, existentialism, all came about as a reaction to realism. And again, I quote Xu Xu here. He says, "Humans have a desire for their own minds to explore dreams and illusions in order to obtain a deeper understanding of reality." This is because, again, he believed among the totality of reality a person can grasp, there's nothing like the reality that can be engaged with in one's own mind. Even the external world examined by an individual is nothing but the impressions and experiences that exist in one individual's mind. So in the afterword, then, I look at some of his works like Bird Talk and The Old Souls Tree, but also a few others that I didn't translate, that really epitomize this kind of literary idealism. And then I compare him to a number of other 20th century neo-romantics, especially Hermann Hesse, who had gotten the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1946 or 1947, the first post-war Nobel Prize, I think. And, you know, and Xu Xu, you know, he was very well read. He read French and English. He actually spent some time in America. He translated some English. He was very interested in what was going on in the global literary scene. He wrote a lot of essays and just cultural criticism that were published in Hong Kong. And what's really interesting, I think, is that there is a clear sort of kinship, artistic kinship between Hesse and Xu Xu in their apparent preference for first person and at times quasi-autobiographical narrators. They both frequently make use of changing narrative perspectives that switch between first and second person narration. They both engage in their work with mythicism, spirituality, the surreal. They celebrated in their fiction and also in their poetry. Xu Xu also wrote a lot of poetry, the sublimity of love. And then, you know, the image of the restless wanderer, which of course is epitomized in Hesse's iconic Steppenwolf, really found its counterpart in many of Xu Xu's Hong Kong stories. You know, these people stranded in Hong Kong, where they don't really feel they belong, and they, you know, they're driven by this yearning for something else, for a world or a love lost. And, you know, again, something that we see in Bird Talk. Now, this idea or this concept of transnational romanticism, transnational Chinese romanticism, is a concept I borrowed from the critic and philosopher Michel Levy, a Brazilian literary critic, who has written on the global romantic revival in the 20th century, a book called Tide Against Romanticism, I think. I'm blanking out on the title here. Levy, you know, he believes that romanticism really is a Weltanschauung or a worldview that may be expressed in quite diverse cultural realms, you know, many of which we haven't previously kind of included in the canon of romanticism. And I kind of argue in the afterword that Xu Xu's fiction clearly possesses the virtues of enabling the critic to recognize the cultural multiplicity of romanticism that Levy kind of mentions. But, you know, to describe Xu Xu's aesthetics as a form of transnational Chinese romanticism really is above all a, you know, a heuristic gesture. Romanticism, I think, as a conceptual tool, can help us discern the shared features and preoccupations of a set of 20th century texts that all respond to similar historical circumstances in similar ways. And it's through the lens of this redefined romanticism then that Xu Xu's work really partakes in what Levy describes as a highly diverse global literary modernity, and that Xu Xu's readers were and maybe still are able to find, you know, metaphysical sanctuaries from their mundane existence and various challenges to their lives.
The prose is definitely gripping. Like, you just forget about everything indeed and just keep reading. So it's, yeah, it's easy in a way to see how the search for expression and also responding to, you know, conditions on the ground might enable such conversations, right, between authors and between currents of thoughts. And I think that's more apparent in the writing than in the pictures, but then the book does have does include some pictures, right?
Do you mean the picture on the cover or the pictures in the book? Let me say the cover, yeah. So the cover is a Japanese woodblock print by the late artist Kawano Kaoru. Yep. When I first saw it, I could not believe how fitting a visual rendering of the story Bird Talk it was. And listeners probably now should pause and they should Google the book and take a look at the cover.
It's amazing, yeah.
It's a girl sitting against a dark background and appearing to converse with a bright yellow bird that sits on her knees. And it really captures the beauty and purity of this protagonist, this young girl. But, you know, the sadness that permeates the story is also all in that image. And, you know, I was able to track down the daughter of the artist. The artist passed away in the 60s. And I asked her whether I could use it for the book, and she was delighted. And she said, yes, please go ahead. I nothing would make me happier than to know that my father's work kind of lives on. So that, you know, I'm really excited about the cover. But yes, in the middle of the book, there is a bunch of images that I'm equally excited about. So the first one is a map of Shanghai from 1932. And in the, you know, on the side, I listed all the places that were mentioned in the different stories, because the street grid of Shanghai was really important to Chinese modernist writers of the 20s and 30s. Just, you know, just like the grid of Berlin or Tokyo was important to modernist writers in Germany or Japan. Now, the photos of Xuxi are also very special. I really wanted to have a photo from each creative period, precisely because, as we already discussed, you know, the narrator in his stories is kind of always plays this trick on his writers, and it's kind of almost quasi-autobiographical. So I thought it would be nice to see how Xuxi maybe wanted to be seen himself or presented himself. So, and his daughter kindly gave me access to many of these personal photographs, most of which have never been published before. But also, you know, a manuscript. So there's a page from a manuscript with his handwriting that is reproduced. And, you know, then some book covers and journal covers. And then there is a photo that I really like. That's a still from the movie Blind Love, Manglian, that was filmed in 1955, that is based on a short story of the same name. And Xuxi actually had a role in that movie. He plays kind of himself at the opening of the movie, and he finds this manuscript that he then reads out to his friends, and the friends all turn out to be the cast of the movie. And then, you know, I reproduced a photo of him with the entire cast of the movie. Some of them, you know, like Luo Wei, Lili Hua, these are really, really famous stars who had come to Hong Kong from Shanghai, you know, after the war, and who kind of were instrumental in you know, kind of getting the movie industry going in Hong Kong. And of course, Hong Kong later on really became the East Asian Hollywood. And as I already said, several of his works were turned into movies. And then there is one very special photo. You know, I really like ships of all kinds, and I was really excited to include an image of a ship. And this ship is the SS Conteverde, which was an Italian liner of the Italian Lloyd Triestino line that ran a regular service from Trieste in Italy to Shanghai throughout the 1930s. And the photo shows the Conteverde moored quayside on the Huangpu River in Shanghai in the mid-1930s. And it's actually the ship that Xuxi took when he traveled to Europe in 1936, and which is then the setting of the story, The Jewish Comet, the story about the Jewish woman from Shanghai who, together with her Chinese lover, venture on this secret sabotage mission against Franco's fascist forces. Now, what's really interesting is that Jews actually formed a considerable contingent of foreigners living in Shanghai. Some of them were Baghdadi Jews who had come with the British following actually the Opium Wars already in the late 19th century. And then others were Russian Jews who had fled the homeland following the revolution and the civil war. And then, you know, in the wake of Hitler's rise in Germany, and especially, you know, the violent kind of first anti-Semitic attacks, Night of Broken Glass of 1938, Shanghai saw an influx of some 18,000 European Jews who fled, you know, persecution in Germany and the territories that would soon fall under German control. You know, so Shanghai had this peculiar international settlement in the center of the city, which had been a product of the Opium Wars, which was sort of a semi-colonial, self-controlled territory. So it was under foreign jurisdiction. And, you know, this international settlement was one of the only places in the world where you didn't need a visa. So if you could get to Shanghai, if you could get a ship to Shanghai, you couldn't be turned back. So Shanghai became one of the last safe havens for Jews desperate to leave Europe. And incidentally, this ship, you know, the Italian liner Conteverde and the sister ship Conte Rosso that sailed from ports in Italy, that was, of course, an Axis partner of Germany, so it was possible to go to Italy, they played a crucial role in helping many of those Jews reach Shanghai. And that's why I wanted to include this photo of this ship.
That's fascinating. It's and you know, it does tell a story that somehow Xuxu touches upon, right? So the history of the Jewish population in Shanghai, but you know, it's kind of creeping into the story, but then with the picture you can actually tell a more broader, right, kind of context. And also, you know, harken back to histories of connection and shipping and immigration and so on. So, I know there's a lot to say here, but, you know, I was wondering whether there's anything that you'd like to add that we have not touched upon so far.
Just a couple of things. I mentioned that, you know, Xuxu really was incredibly prolific. His complete works, when they were first published, consisted of 15 volumes. And while most of it is fiction, several volumes are actually dedicated to poetry, drama, prose essays, literary criticism. And, you know, while I hope that my anthology provides a somewhat representative selection, at least of his fiction, it's, you know, by no means exhaustive. And what I regret a little bit is that I didn't include any poetry. Now, some of his poetry was actually translated by the late Kai Xu in his important anthology, 20th Century Chinese Poetry. And it's kind of funny. Kai Xu was the founder of the Chinese program at San Francisco State University, where I now teach. So it's kind of, again, coming full circle.
Yeah.
But, you know, when Xu was chairing, he later chaired the Chinese program at Baptist University in Hong Kong. And he started to write a history of 20th century Chinese literature, which he sadly could not complete because of his untimely death. So, you know, in a way, I really only show one facet of Xuxu's work. And there's, you know, there's so much more in a way to this writer and intellectual. But I quickly wanted to follow up on an earlier question that you asked me, namely whether these stories are representative maybe of an entire generation, and whether they spoke and maybe still speak to readers. You know, even though these stories are now well over 50 years old, most of them, they strangely, I think, still seem to resonate with readers. So his complete works were actually just recently reissued in both China and Taiwan. And Xuxu has seen a real resurgence in interest in the Chinese-speaking world. So Ghost Love was turned into a play in Shanghai a few years ago, into a chamber opera in Hong Kong. And then a couple of years ago, the famous Shanghai writer Wang Anyi actually turned this spy novel, The Rustling Wind, Feng Xiaoxiao, into a play in Shanghai. So there's definitely something that still resonates with Chinese readers. And then, you know, a couple of days ago, I read a review of my book by Isabella Zheng in the South China Morning Post, a Hong Kong newspaper, written, you know, in English language Hong Kong newspaper. And the review was entitled Bird Talk, in Xuxu's short stories, Hong Kong is a symbol of new beginnings and opportunity. And what I thought was really interesting is that, you know, in her review, she makes every story, each of these five stories, somehow relevant to Hong Kong of today. She sort of makes a connection to, you know, the situation of Hong Kong today. And she kind of reclaims Xuxu for Hong Kong. And that's so interesting because Xuxu himself never really felt at home in Hong Kong. And he did not like the city and he didn't like its commercial culture. And he thought of it as sort of a cultural desert. But at the same time, you know, Hong Kong was the only place where he could go. He was a writer who wrote in Chinese, who needed an audience, you know, he needed a readership. But he had fallen out of favor with his regime, you know, the new regime in Beijing, in mainland China. He hated Chiang Kai-shek's regime in Taiwan. And, you know, he did find a home in Hong Kong. So I think, you know, his fiction really speaks to readers who find themselves in a tight spot and who are in need of hope or solace or maybe just distraction. You see, Xu's most famous literary work, his wartime spy novel, The Rustling Wind, was published amid the chaos of World War II. And I think it really gives solace to his readers. And it's almost a strange coincidence that this English language debut now falls into the middle of a global pandemic.
Yes.
But it's also quite appropriate. As we discussed, his works often provided solace to his readers in times of hardship. And, you know, maybe these translations can achieve something similar at this challenging moment. I'd be humbled if they did, if they provided some solace and entertainment to readers. So
I'm sure. And, you know, it's... the whole book is just marvelous, and I full-heartedly recommend it to everybody who wants to read and, you know, just find everything that you said, right? Either it's solace or it's, you know, just satisfying curiosity or, you know, kind of preparing to teach or anything of that, or, you know, trying to find some sort of, you know, personal connection in time in troubled times, or, you know, just everything is there in the anthology. So I think we have taken a lot of your time, and you know, I don't want to take more of it. But before ending the interview, I wanted to ask about what you're working on right now. What are your current projects?
Oh, well, you know, there's, of course, always more Xu to read. But
sure.
At this time, it's kind of, I never get tired of reading him. But I think, you know, I also work on, you know, I like working on other things, too. I've done a couple of projects that sort of took me into the late Qing period. I've worked on poetry from the late Qing that sort of... was poetry that engaged with visual art, sort of the encounter of Chinese poets with Western painting, which is something that I was, you know, I kind of would like to pursue a little further. But this interest in Qing Dynasty poetry has has then led me to 19th century poetry written in Chinese, classical style poetry written in Chinese, that was actually written by Japanese colonial officials in Taiwan, which is sort of my newest project. I'm looking at these classical style Chinese poems that were written by Japanese colonial officials in Taiwan at the beginning of the colonial period, which is kind of ironic, which, you know, we sort of think of this as the beginning of kind of Taiwanese modernity, right? The beginning of the colonial period, Japan bringing modernity to the island. But this first encounter with Taiwan was kind of processed by these Japanese officials by way of classical Chinese prose, which they, of course, were all, you know, proficient in and knew how to write. So that's a new project that I've actually just started. So
fascinating. That's amazing. And I personally look forward to, I'm sure the listeners as well are looking forward to reading, you know, that project when it comes out. You know, I really look forward to more work coming, you know, in translation or not, from Xu, and, you know, from this analysis of Japanese officials that you are looking at. And with that, I want to thank you very, very much for talking to us today, Frederick, and wish you good luck with the new work.
Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure. And thank you for those great questions. And thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.